And I'm looking forward to the update. So Teresa Colletta.
I know we're recording, so I'm going to go ahead and hold this. I am delighted to be here. This is a special group. I was down in Florida and had the opportunity to talk to some of your members, including Tom Monahan, who I had the privilege of serving on the board of his first law school up in Michigan. And so I'm a huge fan of this group. You all can really impact the culture. And at some point, you know, that's a whole different talk, which I'm sure other people are more expert on, of how corporate and business leadership can actually help us restore an authentic Catholic culture to our community. So thank you for being here. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for letting me talk. I'm the director of the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas. It is an unfunded initiative, but nonetheless, I spent 5 years being mad about that. But then I decided, you know, the cool thing is I get free use of the classroom. There are some subversive pro-lifers in the tech area, right, who are like totally happy. Oh, Professor Colette, you need recording. Oh, Professor Colette, do you need tech? Oh, Professor Colette, do you need... So there are some really great people at St. Thomas. Just not. All right, I didn't say that. We are not.
It did not get recorded.
When you said that, I thought I did. Okay. So it's a terrific place, and because of that, though, I have the opportunity to have students work with me on these cases. I, as a matter of, in that capacity, and also just as a private lawyer, my usual fee for pro-life clients. So I recently did a speech for a fundraiser for one of the pregnancy care centers, and my fee was a chocolate bar with almonds, which is why my skirt doesn't fit very well. But, you know, as Jim said, the reality is we're all working for the retirement, right? I mean, I'm aiming for that closet in heaven after purgatory. It'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so because that's about what I'm expecting. So I filed three briefs in the United States Supreme Court in the Mississippi case. I'm going to talk primarily about the Mississippi case because that's the case that everybody's watching at one level, because that's the case that holds the potential to reverse Roe versus Wade. And we're going to talk about so what. What does that mean? I'm going to use my slides, which will be made available to you through your membership director. So I saw someone, and it's deeply flattering when you see people pull out their pens and like, oh, I'm going to take notes. Awesome. My students don't do that very often. Right. But you will have access to the slides if you'd like them. And so I want to talk primarily about the Dobbs case. I am certainly happy to talk about the Texas case. I am a former Texan. And I actually know the fellow who was, according to Justice Sotomayor, the evil genius who came up with the Texas law. So I'm happy to talk about it. I've served as Special Assistant Attorney General both in Oklahoma and in Kansas defending their pro-life laws. So I sort of understand. And Greg Abbott, it's too strong now, having been out of Texas for 18 years, to say he's a personal friend, but he's certainly a professional acquaintance that I've spent some time with. So I'm happy to talk about the Texas law as well. But let's talk about Dobbs, because December 1st, we're going to hear those oral arguments, and I'll be there, and I'm excited. I was invited by the Mississippi Attorney General to join her in Washington, D.C., not for the oral arguments, but to simply be there as moral support for her. So let's talk about what it is. You can see my illustration, because in reality, this is the public perception. Sorry, guys, you just don't get a vote in this. It's, right? It's women versus women. And one of the briefs that I was counsel of record on is a brief of 240 women scholars and professional women. Every one of our clients had what we call a terminal degree, PhD, MD, JD. They all had doctorates in whatever they did. Not because women who have anything less than a doctorate aren't important, and in fact doing most of the work in American society, but because we were trying to dissuade the court from this ridiculous notion that women only succeed because of access to abortion. And so we had 240 women sign on to the brief, as well as the governor of North Dakota. Okay. In addition to that, and some of you may recoil, but I'm proud to join them because I call myself, I'm a papal feminist. And that really twists people's minds. Okay. But I am totally a JP2 girl, right? The feminine genius. Yeah. I am all about it. And so I don't have any trouble embracing that title. Absolutely, I'm a feminist. Absolutely, I'm a papal feminist. Read JP2 on the dignity of women. And so it's not a problem. And so we represented 7 pro-life feminist groups as well. And I should also note that Justice Amy Coney Barrett was a student of mine for one semester. So there we be. All right. And John Finnis, a dear colleague. So, all right. So let's get started. All right. Here's our agenda. And I talk really fast, which is why, yes, the slides will be available. My students, at one point I was put on, what's it called, the music thing?
Oh, yeah, the metronome.
Metronome, yes. One of my students brought me a metronome and said, Professor, I'd like to put you on this for purposes of your lecture. So I know I talk really fast. I hope you listen really fast. All right, here we go.
They're hard to read.
A quick review of Roe versus Wade. Exactly, this slows me down because the slides make me right. A quick review of Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton holdings. Some of you may not have heard of the second case. It's absolutely crucial. Quick review of Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And then the actual case that's in the court, Dobbs versus Jackson and Women's Health. We'll talk about what the law actually is, the issues presented in the arguments, possible outcomes, and its impacts on the state. Let's cut to the ultimate conclusion. Ladies and gentlemen, even if we reverse Roe versus Wade, you guys are super important because guess what? Not a dang thing's going to change in Minnesota.
Yep.
So we need you all to, you know, enlist. I'm in the God's army. Yes, you can tell I was a Protestant as a child. All right. We need you all to get on board because Minnesota has a state constitutional opinion that will stand regardless of what happens with Roe. But that doesn't mean those of you who are snowbirds, something I aspire to, that doesn't mean the other state that you live in won't be deeply affected by this opinion. So let's go. All right. Here is the real Roe versus Wade, not the New York Times version, not that anyone in this room reads the New York Times. I actually do. But here's what the court said. Restrictive criminal abortion laws in effect in a majority of states today are of relatively recent vintage. Those laws derive from statutory changes effective for the most part in the latter half of the 19th century. This is actually completely false history. The court used what it believed to be a historical analysis by an abortion advocate to justify Roe versus Wade and has never referred to it since because it was so patently false that they were embarrassed. They never went back to this part of the opinion, but it was a major part of the opinion because it was an abortion advocate who happened to be a professor, surprise, 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 at a university who wrote the article, and it was completely false. Medical developments have made abortion, quote, relatively safe, close quote, in contrast to when Texas and other states' prohibitions were passed. Now, in all fairness, that's probably a true statement, because when the prohibitions were passed in the 1800s, we didn't have antibiotics. And one of the major adverse consequences of abortion, besides the death of the child, is septic infections. Right, and so now all abortion providers put women on a prophylactic regime of antibiotics. You take antibiotics for 3 days to make sure. The other major complication is retained fetal parts. Sorry, welcome to partial birth abortion in the world in which I lived. I wrote the medical brief that supported the federal act. So they're right. I mean, that's true. Compared to pre-antibiotic days, if you introduce any sort of instrument into a woman's body or a man's body, you're likely to get an infection. And then we got antibiotics, and so it is safer than it was when those laws were passed. States should not intrude on private consultations between physicians and their patients regarding care. This is kind of a remarkable conclusion for the simple reason that doctors are not free to prescribe controlled substances when they are not medically indicated. In fact, the way we took down Dr. Gosnell in Philadelphia, the infamous abortion provider who was such a bigot among other things, was because he was dealing illicit drugs out of his medical practice. They actually had several reports of women injured during abortions. They didn't care about that. In fact, the Pennsylvania Department of Health suppressed those. But when they found out he was dealing drugs, well, now we got to go investigate him. And they found the horrific practices. So this idea that there's some sort of zone of silence between doctor and patient that the state cannot possibly intrude in, well, that presumes they're doing something legal, which is simply and was not the case prior to Roe. All right. They overturned every abortion limitation in the state in the United States, including some which permitted abortion within limits as violating the Constitution. There was actually a referendum in the state of Washington where the people voted to legalize abortion subject to spousal consent, parental consent, only for a limited period of pregnancy. So there were liberalizations of the abortion laws. New York, of course, is a classic example of that. The Supreme Court threw them all out. And it established what we now know as a trimester system. It said that the state has no interest in women obtaining abortion related to the first trimester. So we have a 40-week period of pregnancy. So that first third of that, the state can't do anything. They can't require physicians only. They can't require certain medication, which is, of course, medication drugs are now common. According to Roe, we couldn't regulate that. And then only regulations reasonably related to the maternal health. And isn't it interesting, they use maternal. They use the word mother throughout Roe versus Wade. They weren't completely, right, disconnected from reality. They recognized the woman was a mother as soon as she got pregnant, right? But reasonably related to maternal health during the second trimester. So you couldn't care about the baby in the second third. But you could have physician-only requirements. You could have safety requirements generally for women. And then finally, and here's the kicker, may prescribe abortions except where it is necessary in appropriate medical judgment for the preservation of the life or the health of the mother. Now, that sounds really narrow. That sounds pretty sensible if you are, you know, accepting of abortion as a concept generally. The states can prohibit it. Unfortunately, that's not what the court meant. It was legalese double talk. Because simultaneously with Roe versus Wade, and this is the Doe versus Bolton opinion, those of you who are active in the pro-life movement, forgive me for telling you what you already know. Those of you who have, you know, supported us but not been deeply embedded in the pro-life movement, this is why pro-lifers say that there's really no limit to abortion, that it's abortion on demand throughout all 9 months. Because in Doe versus Bolton, the court said, we agree with the district court that the medical judgment may be exercised in light of all factors. We're talking about the health exception. Physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient. All of these factors may relate to health. This allows the attending physician the room he needs to make his best medical judgment. And it is the room that operates for the benefit, not the disadvantage of the pregnant woman. So a woman, and there has been congressional testimony to this effect by the author of the first textbook on abortion for med schools, where he came in and he testified anytime a woman's distressed by her pregnancy, that threatens her mental health, and therefore she is entitled to an abortion in the last trimester of pregnancy because her mental health is at risk. So it's a false barrier. It's the exception that swallows the rule. And in fact, the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas filed a brief on this particular aspect with the court in the Mississippi case saying, not only must you look at Roe and Casey, but you've got to evaluate W. Bolton. Because if what you say, and here's one of my big fears, it's a very Robertsian opinion that worries me, referring, of course, to Chief Justice Roberts, is they could say, sure, we reverse Roe versus Wade, no problem. There's no text to support it. There's no history to support it. There's no tradition to support it. Happy to do it. And we reverse Planned Parenthood versus Casey because it was just a derivation of it, and it doesn't have any support as established by the women's brief, et cetera, et cetera. But because we don't historically restrict recognized, quote, medical procedures, close quote, see briefs of the American Medical Association, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, because we don't typically restrict the professional discretion of the medical profession, you must have a broad health exception to any law that would prohibit abortion. And the abortion industry pops champagne corks, okay? Because they've reversed Roe, they've reversed Casey, but they've said the only laws that will survive is if they have an exception that includes physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the women's age. So it is the exception that swallows the rule. All right, so keep your eye on the ball. All right, so that was Roe versus Wade. 20 years later, the court was presented with a case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Of course, this is Governor Robert Casey, an authentic pro-life Democrat who said, you know, we're going to do everything we can to diminish abortion. We're going to do it by supporting women who are struggling to continue their pregnancies while simultaneously regulating and trying to limit to the greatest extent possible. Now, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, it's very small print, but my main point here is that there were five separate opinions. What does that tell you about the legitimacy of Roe versus Wade when you can't get an opinion that you've got four justices to agree on? You've got five different justices writing five different opinions at Ravina, five different justifications for the case. And when that happens, it's called a plurality opinion. The lawyers in the room know that the plurality opinion is the controlling opinion of the case where you've got at least five justices who agree on the outcome, but they can't figure out why. Okay? So you and I all agree that 16-year-old daughters should be home by midnight. Some of you think it's because boys drive too fast at midnight. Others of you think, because I need to go to sleep. Others of you think, it's because
bad things happen after midnight.
Okay, whatever, all right? But as long as we have a majority of us agree that everybody's daughter has to be home at midnight, we have a ruling. But if we don't have a majority who agree on why, I just want to go to bed, all right, then the narrowest opinion is the one that controls. And that's what a plurality opinion is, okay? So in this case, the plurality opinion was written by, among others, Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor. And I've got to admit, I do, forgive me, Father, I bear a little ill will still for Justice O'Connor, because it adopts an analysis that just infuriates me. First, it rejects Roe versus Wade's rigid trimester system, okay? And it says states should be able to adopt laws that seek to persuade women. That's why our informed consent laws work. It adopts the undue burden analysis, which is a nightmare for lawyers because we have no idea what this analysis is, what constitutes an undue burden, how many women have to be burdened, et cetera. And they say, well, it's a law that has its purpose or effect place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. So if we require her to meet with a pregnancy care center, as Alabama has just passed, if you're a minor, that's an undue burden because it doesn't really fit nicely into persuading women to choose childbirth over abortion. It's an undue obstacle. Really? It retains the central holding of Roe. In other words, they refuse to overrule Roe, which is what we're hoping for in Dobbs. And says a state may not prohibit any woman from making the ultimate decision to terminate her pregnancy before viability. And then they again reiterate, the state may prescribe abortion except where it's necessary for the preservation of the life or health of the mother. Fortunately, they had a much narrower exception for health, but here's, as a lawyer litigating these cases, which I have done for the past 30 years, I have no idea what this rule of law is, and that's a huge problem. Nor do the courts, frankly. If I'm in Texas, the rules are different than if I'm in Connecticut, or if I'm in New Hampshire, and certainly if I'm in Minnesota. I don't know what a substantial obstacle is. I know what the Minnesota Supreme Court says. I know what the New Hampshire Federal District Court says. I know what the Second Circuit says. But I have to look at every single court instead of there being a national standard, which is really weird with Supreme Court jurisprudence. What's a large fraction? Is it a majority of cases? Okay, well, why didn't they say majority? So the abortion industry says that can't be the right interpretation, and fair enough. I'll give them that one. Is it a third? Is it a quarter? Is it a tenth? I don't know what a large fraction is. And how is relevance determined? So it's a ridiculous standard that has led to consistent and continuous litigation. Okay, so where are we now? Well, the Supreme Court took this case, and there's a whole debate about why they took this case, because it's not the case I would have predicted they would have taken. In 2019, the Mississippi legislature passed House Bill 1510, the Gestational Age Act. The law allows abortions after 15 weeks gestation age, only in cases of medical emergencies or for severe fetal anomalies. Now, I can tell you, having looked at the state reports of every state that reports on the reason for abortions, medical emergencies happen in less than 1% of all cases. They're virtually unknown. There are very rare cases, but they are stunningly rare. Justifications. Why did Mississippi pass this? God bless Mississippi. Because the risk of a mother's death from abortion at 16 to 20 weeks is 35 times more likely than at 8 weeks. And the relative risk of mortality increases by 38% for each additional week in higher gestation. So this myth that abortion is safer than childbirth, depends on when the abortion occurs. Now, in all fairness, safer to whom? Okay, let's just accept that, right, it's lethal to the child. Let's set that aside, that's accepted. But even women, when you get to 16 to 20 weeks, it's more dangerous to abort than it is to continue the pregnancy. The human fetus develops neural circuitry capable of detecting and responding to pain at 10 to 12 and at 14 to 20 weeks. The doctors in the group, forgive me, it's the thalamus, I know that, circuitry develops that can support a conscious awareness of pain. This is a really disputed area. I actually testified in front of Congress of when do unborn babies begin to experience pain. But one of the interesting things that's really awesome is one of our biggest opponents out of England just flipped his position because of some new research. Mm-hmm. Just flipped his position. I've testified in Minnesota. I've testified in Alabama, I've testified in a number of states that at 20 weeks gestation, the brain is sufficiently developed and connected to the spinal cord that the child can feel pain. Why do we know that? Because if you touch it, the child draws away. The child will seek to avoid adverse stimuli. The blood testing, it gets all sorts of blood chemistry that shows it's in pain. So we know that at 20 weeks, okay? Mississippi's a little aggressive at 10 to 12, but that's what lawyers are known for. And then finally, the majority of abortion procedures performed after 15 weeks gestation are dilation and evacuation procedures, which involve the use of surgical instruments to crush and tear the unborn child apart before removing the pieces of the dead child from the womb. That's actually a fairly polite description of it. Again, I did the medical brief in the partial birth abortion case, both in the Nebraska case and subsequently in the federal case. And I will tell you that it's called live dismemberment, and that's an accurate description. And we have what is called the Federal Humane Slaughter Law. If these children were cows or pigs, we would not allow it. It would be illegal under federal law. And I'll leave it at that. All right. So, Mississippi took it up to the Supreme Court because they lost at the trial court, they lost at the intermediate appellate court, and they said, are all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions unconstitutional? Roe versus Wade said they were. It appears that Casey kind of says that, but again, we're back to Casey is completely ambiguous. Whether the validity of pre-viability law that protects women's health, the dignity of the unborn child, and the integrity of the medical profession and society should be analyzed under the undue burden standard. There's a case after Casey Hellerstadt. I won't take the time. This is slides that I developed for my law students. And whether abortion providers have third-party standing to invalidate a law that protects women's health from the dangers of late-term abortion. Let me take them one by one. The only issue the Supreme Court took is the first one. The only issue the Supreme Court took is the first one. Are all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions unconstitutional? Why did they take this? Many of my colleagues in the pro-life movement believe the only reason they would take that issue is to reverse Roe. I will tell you, I am not as optimistic as they are. Okay. And these are experienced litigators that have been in this fight as long as I have, so I'm not going to say that, oh, you naive little puppies. Okay, these are experienced litigators. They are the only, they think, why would you take that if you're not going to change the law? Now, remember, it only takes four justices to accept a case. It takes five to win a case. And so, and this case was up before the U.S. Supreme Court on cert for over 18 months, which is bizarre. The court usually answers you within 2 to 3 months, okay? So it feels like they were A, waiting on Amy, okay? But B, they were also trying to solidify and make sure they had the five votes because you don't want to take it with four and then lose, okay? So that's why a lot of people are wildly optimistic, including Professor Robert George, who I assume everybody in this room has great respect and admiration for, as do I, although he's just flat wrong in this case. Okay.
Yeah. How reliable do you think Justice Roberts
is? I'm going to get there. Okay. The second question, here's what's cool about it, is it lays out why should government care? Because we care about women's health, the dignity of the unborn child, the integrity of the medical profession and society. All right. And then the third one is totally a geek thing, which I am like the geekiest of geeks in most of this, which is it's infuriating to me that abortion providers can come in and attack health and safety laws, like physician-only requirements. They're doing it in Minnesota courts right now, and our attorney general is defending the rule. But they have come in and said, you know, you can't limit it to doctors. And who are you representing? Industry, abortion industry. Oh, we're representing our patients who are deprived of. Really, would we let the tobacco industry represent all of the people in America? It's unbelievable. So this is another anomaly that if they don't reverse Roe, this is like my hobby horse. Why are you letting the abortion industry attack health and safety laws in the guise of protecting women? What a bunch of nonsense. Okay. Here you go, sir. All right, possible outcomes. God is good. We've been on our knees in prayers enough. I don't believe that for a minute. And so we get a 6-3 majority, yes. I don't think so. All right. But what would the lineup be? We would get Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Barrett, and Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor would be sobbing in their beers at the end of the day. Okay? Now, of those three, Kagan is the dangerous one. She's super smart. And she was dean at Harvard Law School. And she writes very well. I mean, if I wanted to, and I actually think there's some benefit of clerking under the devil, if I wanted to do that, that's what I would clerk under. Okay, I mean, she's super smart, and she'll write a powerful opinion, whatever it is. Okay, Sotomayor is Sotomayor. And Breyer will tag along with Kagan. 5-4. All right, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. We lose Roberts. Why do we lose Roberts? We lose Roberts because of institutional reputation. It's the same reason we lost the Obamacare case, right? He is deeply concerned about how the court is perceived by the public. Now, here's the reality. A little secret that Justice Roberts ought to know, Chief Justice Roberts ought to know. It doesn't matter which way they come out. People are going to say it's political opinion. They can affirm Roe, and we're going to say it's political. They can overturn Roe, and the other side's going to say it's political. You're not going to escape that outcome, Chief Justice. So, like, just quit hoping for that and do the right thing. Either it's constitutional law based on text, history, tradition, and practice, or it's not. Just rule the right way. But we've seen him do it before. So that's why we would lose him. An opinion of 4-2-3. Now we're in that plurality territory again, right? Now we've got perhaps agreement on the outcome, but not agreement on the rationale. Who do we lose? We lose Kavanaugh and Roberts. Kavanaugh and Roberts have voted together. That is the most common combination among the conservative justices. And part of the strategy, I think, of the attack on Kavanaugh during the confirmation proceedings was to make sure he could never vote to overturn Roe. Because if you're a sexual predator, right, I mean, overturning Roe would be just unthinkable, because you want to be able to eliminate the evidence of your misconduct. And so how dare he, you know, as this predator, right? Whatever. Now, the other way it could cut is, I am sick and tired of this intimidation, and I, you know, his spine could be completely stiffened, and he'll stay with us, and we'll get 5-4 even if we lose Roberts. We could end up, and here's pretty close to where I'm going to end, we could end up with 3-3-3, and that is my biggest concern. We know we've got Thomas, we know we've got Alito. They've said it for decades. Roe is wrong. Why aren't we overturning it? All it's doing is keeping the court in turmoil. Get rid of it. We're done. We're done. We're done. We know we have those two. Gorsuch is John Finnis student. Now, it didn't help us in the transgender case. Frankly, the lawyers in the room know what I'm talking about. But Justice Gorsuch wrote a rather, and I don't use the term favorably, remarkable opinion, saying that our sex discrimination laws at the federal level encompass transgender, even though transgender wasn't a thing at the time we passed those laws. Okay. John Finnis has been, he was a mentor of mine when I visited Notre Dame. He has been a stalwart in the marriage debate. He's been a stalwart in sexual morality, and it didn't matter to Gorsuch, even though he is an acolyte of Finnis. All right, so I'm a little worried about Gorsuch, but let's say we hold him. So we've got Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. The next three, which would be, I fear, the plurality, would be Chief Justice Roberts, Mr. It's all about the institutional reputation of the court, Kavanaugh, his sidekick, and Justice Barrett. And it breaks my heart to say it. But Justice Barrett's opinion in the Fulton case this past session, Fulton is where the question was, in Massachusetts, could a Catholic foster care center continue to operate consistent with religious principles of Catholic belief, that we're not going to place children in same-sex union households. And at issue was the Supreme Court rule for free exercise of religion. And a lot of conservatives were really excited that we might restore a more robust free exercise test. Okay, because right now the question is, well, is this a generally applicable, facially neutral law? And if it is, it's all fine. Now, let's just take a breath, and I know time-wise, so I'm trying to go fast. In Prohibition, imagine, federal law says sale and production of wine is illegal. Father, what's that do to you? Celebration of the Mass? Yeah, we got a problem, right? Now, Congress was smart enough in Prohibition to actually create an exception. That's how some of the more prominent wineries actually got started, is they continued to supply the churches during that time. But if that's a facially neutral law. Nobody can produce or sell wine, including to Catholic churches. That's a real problem. Now, I recognize there are actually some exceptions in prison situations, and so I know theologically we can do the canon law thing, but let's not. But that's a tough rule for believers. And that wasn't the rule until one of my heroes, Justice Scalia, wrote the opinion. And so there were a lot of us who were really hoping for a more robust free exercise test. And Justice Barrett wrote an opinion that said, until we can figure out a better test, we're just going to let this bad test stay in effect. You see why I'm worried about Amy? Pray for Amy. Pray for Amy. Okay? And then you've got, of course, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor. Maybe we'll get Kagan. Some of my friends seem to think we might be able to. I think they are wildly optimistic. And so, which is to say, I don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't know. We got Gorsuch's transgender endorsement, and we got Amy's it's too hard to figure out a new test problem, and we got Chief Justice Roberts, well, nobody will like us problem. And those are our conservatives. Yeah. So, who writes the opinion? If the most senior justice does it, if it's Thomas and Amy's on the side of the angels, she'll write it, which I think is brilliant. I've often said we would never reverse Roe till we got a pro-life woman on the court, because the blowback will be horrific. Okay, so we need a pro-life woman. She's just got to have the courage of her conviction. She is a faithful woman. She is a member of People of Praise. She believes it. She was raised in it. She's a good woman. But even Thomas Aquinas said the judge is not responsible for applying an unjust law correctly. So, super smart lady. Chief Justice, we've got the Obamacare penalty as a tax problem. We know that that Justice Thomas will write a barn burner in concurrence with Amy, hopefully. And then Justice Gorsuch, I've outlined all that. Final comments, impact of reversing Roe. I've already given you the bottom line for Minnesota, so what?
Okay.
But courts in at least 10 states have declared access to abortion as a state constitutional right, that be us, and 13 states provide statutory protection. I've got litigation going on in New York right now over that, where they lit up the Empire State Building celebrating that they could kill babies all the way up to the moment of birth. Half of the states would likely enact laws that are restrictive, according to the abortion industry. According to pro-life groups, in some, no more than 11 states would have enforceable laws on the books prohibiting most or all abortions upon the overturning of Roe. Those 11 states account for only 20% of the population of the United States, and the other 39, where 80% of the population lives. Abortion would be legal for most or all reasons throughout pregnancy. And even in those 11 states, there may be some doubt as to whether all those statutes would be enforceable. All right, done.
Jackson, Teresa, you made the statement that Professor Robbie George is wrong. What is he wrong about in the law?
He is making the argument, along with Professor John Finnis, that pre-Civil War, that the unborn were recognized as constitutional persons, okay? And even Roe v. Wade has a footnote that says, if the unborn are constitutional persons, then the real problem with the Texas law is that it allows abortion in any context, right? The problem is their historical analysis does not comport with the common law of England that was imported, nor the laws of the colonies, nor the laws of the states at the time of ratification of the 14th Amendment, which is where all this goes. It's astute, it's scholarly, but it is cherry-picking the record in all fairness.
It doesn't actually get us to having the 14th Amendment actually protecting me. It doesn't get us there as he thinks it does?
If the court is willing to accept the record as they have presented it, it gets us there. But the weight of historical record would not support that analysis. And you're talking to a woman who was sitting in a Senate hearing, committee hearing, and that was the question they asked me, and I said, I do not think the drafters and the Congress and the states that ratified the 14th Amendment had the unborn in mind. I mean, I think you have to derive it from the practices at the time, and they all allow. Now, I think you can get there if you allow a life of the mother exception, because the government shouldn't pick between two innocent beings, right? I mean, as far as that. But many of them had other exceptions. And at the common law, which is correct, the abortion became a felony or a capital crime in England and in the colonies initially, only after quickening. But there's a reason for that. You couldn't prove the woman was pregnant prior to quickening. It could just be a long-term case of indigestion or, you know, any number, right? It could be a tumor, it could be any number of things, right? So until the baby kicked, and you're not going to hang a man, or you shouldn't hang a man unless you've got adequate proof. And some of us would say probably you shouldn't hang a man generally. But, so I just think they're wildly optimistic. And I will be dancing on the tables with a bottle of champagne. All right, Father, I will really do that. But I mean, you know, I'll be at that banquet the night after oral argument, and when they hand down that opinion, I would love to be proven wrong. But my more.
They're praying for a miracle.
We are. We're all praying for a miracle. And so, yes. Yes, sir.
Does any of the abortion cases coming before the court have anything to do or likely to cause increasing the number of justices? And is that coming into Justice Roberts' mind or anybody, maybe the Democratic side?
Absolutely, it's coming into the Chief Justice Roberts' mind. However, I think the President, given the current, and politics matter, given his current rating, and even Democrats within his party. And remember, the last time we had a court packing scheme, is that the president at that time, vice president, said, this is stupid, this is foolish, we're not going to do it, and we didn't do it. Switch in time saves nine. My fear is not court packing, my fear is the Women's Health Protection Act. And I'm trying to be really appreciative of your time, because I know y'all work really hard and start really early in the day. I'm happy to stick around, but let me give you a one-minute explanation. I testified in front of Congress, in front of a congressional committee last year. It's called the Women's Health Protection Act, which is, like most legislation, completely misnamed. And it would make Roe versus Wade look protective of human life. The standard would be that you could not regulate abortion in any way different than any other procedure, and that even if you chose to do so, like parental consent, right? I mean, you can't perform any other sort of procedure typically on my minor child without my consent, that you have to prove that there is a compelling government interest in allowing the parent to be involved, and that this parental consent is narrowly tailored in order to achieve that objective. And if you fail on either of those counts, the law is illegal. The United States Supreme Court has never never struck down a federal law regarding abortion. Now, that's worked to our advantage because we got the partial birth abortion bill through, we got the Hyde Amendment through, we got, right, so far, woohoo, great precedent. Yeah, you go, court. If they pass Women's Health Protection Act, you know, the only thing we can do is reverse it in legislation because the court's not going to interfere in that sort of dogfight, I don't think. Again, I am sad Sally. So, you know, if you want robust, happy Robbie, I'm a fan, but, you know, I've lost too many cases. I've won a few, too. Partial birth abortion. But I just want folks not to be disheartened and give up because this is our cross. This is our task. We must make this happen. And I, you know, like I said, my waistband is too large because I eat too many chocolate bars with almonds, but I'm okay with that. You know, I could be a partner in a big firm. That's not the choice that God has called me to. And I hope y'all will support these efforts. Mm-hmm.